Chapter 1. Father and Sons. Northward from an Australian city, and hidden from seaward view by high wooded bluffs and green belts of dense windswept scrub, there lies one of the oldest and quaintest little seaport towns on the whole eastern seaboard, from the heat-smitten rocks of Cape York, in the far north of torrid Queensland, to where, 3,000 miles to the south, the sweeping billows from the icy Antarctic leap high in air, and thunder against the grim and rugged walls of stark Cape Howe. The house in which the Wallace family lived stood at the foot of one of these bluffs, within a stone's throw of the beach, and overlooking the bar, and at night time, when the swift outward rush of the river's current met the curling rollers from the open sea, the wild clamor and throbbing hum seemed to shake the walls of the old-fashioned building to its foundations. But to the two Wallace boys who were born in that house, the noise of the beating surf, the hoarse shrieking notes of the myriad seabirds, and the sough of the trade wind through the timbered slopes, were voices that they knew and understood, and were in a manner part and parcel of their own adventurous natures. Let me try and attempt to draw, however rudely, an outline of a picture of their home, and of the sight that every morning the two lads saw from their bedroom window, before they clattered downstairs into the low-caled old-time dining room, to each eat a breakfast that would have done credit to a hungry bullock driver. First, then, the wide, blue Pacific would that I could see it now. Sparkling and shimmering in the yellow sunshine, unbroken in its expanse except for the great dome of Kooringa Rock, a mile from the shore, from which, when the wind blew east, came the unceasing croak and whistle of 10,000 gulls and divers, who made it their rendezvous and sleeping place. To the north, on the other side of the roaring, restless bar, the house was on the southern horn of the entrance to the harbor. There ran a long sweeping half-moon beach, 10 miles from point to point of headland, and backed at high water mark by a thick fringe of low, scrubby timber, the haunt of the black wallaby, and the refuge from pursuit of mobs of wild cattle. Not a dozen people in the little township had ever been through this scrub on foot, but Tom and Jack Wallace knew and loved every foot of it, from the sandspit on the northern bank of the river to the purple loom of the furthest cape. Further back still from this narrow belt of littoral, the main coastal range rose, gray and blue in the distance, monotonous in its outlines, and its silence broken only by the axes of a few wandering parties of timber getters, who worked on the banks of the many streams rising in the mountain gullies, whose waters joined those of the great tidal river on its way to the ocean. Southward from the bar, the coast presented another aspect. High cliffs of black, ironstone rock stood up steep to from the sea, not in a continuous straight line, but in broken irregular masses, forming hundreds of small deep bays with lofty sides, and beaches of large rounded pebbles or snow-white sand. This part of the shore was so wild and desolate, that except themselves, a human being would seldom be seen about it from one year's end to the other, and the boys only went there during the crayfish season, or during an easterly gale, when from the grassy summit of one of the highest cliffs they loved to watch the maddened boil of surf far below, and catch the exhausted gulls and boobies, that sought refuge ashore from the violence of the wind amid the close-set, stunted herbage growing just beyond the reach of the flying spray. Iron-bound and grim-looking, it did not extend more than 6 or 7 miles, and then came another long stretch of sandy beach for thrice that distance, banked up by lofty sand dunes covered with a network of creepers, and a sailing herb known as pigface. Behind the sand hills were a series of brackish lagoons, whose waters were covered with flocks of black swans, pelicans, and half a dozen varieties of wild duck and other waterfowl, which were seldom disturbed by any of the few settlers round about, who were too lazy to wade through water after a duck, although some of them would ride all night to steal a calf or a bullock. These lagoons had, here and there, narrow passages to the sea through the sand mounds, and where this was the case the waters were literally alive with fish bream and whiting, and kingfish and trevally, and but there, the memory of those happy, happy years of boyhood amid such rough and wild surroundings is strong with Tom Wallace still. For the lads, as their father sometimes said, were born in a civilized family by mistake, nature having intended them to have black skins and woolly hair, and to hunt paddy melons and wallabies with boomerang and waddy, like the survivors of the tribe of blacks who still led a lingering existence along the shores and around the tidal lakes and inlets of that part of the country. Of the town itself near which they lived little need be said, except that it was very quaint, and, for a new country like Australia, old-fashioned. Once, in the early days of the colony, it promised to become a thriving and prosperous place. Many retired military and civilian officers had been given very large grants of land in the vicinity of the port, upon which they had settled, and at one time many hundreds of convicts had been employed by them. Besides these, there was a large number of prisoners who toiled on the roads, or in the saw pits, or up on the rivers felling timber, under the supervision of government overseers. These wretched men were generally marched to their work every morning, returning to their barrack prison at night time. There had been at first a company of soldiers stationed at the port, but when it was discovered that the place was ill chosen for a settlement in consequence of the shifting nature of the bar, they were withdrawn to Sydney with all the prisoners, except those who were assigned to the settlers as servants or workmen. Then most of the principal settlers themselves followed, and left their houses untenanted, and their cleared lands to be overgrown, and become swallowed up by the ever-encroaching scrub, which in those humid coastal regions is more an Indian jungle than bush, as Australians understand the word bush. With the soldiers went, of course, the leading civil officials, and the little seaport became semi-deserted. Grass grew in the long, wide streets, and the great red-brick barracks and government storehouses were left to silence and decay. Nearly 20 years after the breaking up of the settlement as a penal establishment, Lester Wallace and his young wife had settled in the place. He had formerly been in the service of the East India Company, where he had accumulated a small fortune. During a visit to Sydney, he had met and married the daughter of one of the Crown officials, an ex-naval officer, and, loath to return to the trying climate of India, decided to remain in Australia, and enter into pastoral pursuits. For a few £1,000 he bought a small cattle station at Port Kooringa, and, in a measure, became the mainstay of the place, for, in addition to cattle raising, he revived the dying timber industry, and otherwise roused the remaining inhabitants of the little port out of their lethargic indifference. But 15 years after he came to the place, and when his two boys were 14 and 13 years of age respectively, his wife died, after a few hours' illness. The blow was a heavy one, and for the time crushed him. He withdrew himself almost entirely from such society as the place afforded, dismissed most of his servants, and lived for more than a year in seclusion, in the lonely house facing the sea. His affection for his children, however, came to his aid, and did much to assuage his grief. "Jack, my lad," he said to the elder boy, one day, as they were riding along the northern beach, "we must stick to each other always. You and Tom are all I have in the world to love. Had your mother lived, I should have liked to have returned to England and ended my days there. But she is gone, and now I have no desire to leave Australia. We shall stay here, Jack, and you and Tom shall help me till you are both old enough to choose your future." Jack, a sturdy, square-built youngster, with honest grey eyes, nodded his head. "I shall never want to leave you in Kooringa, father. I promised mother that before she died. But Tom says he hopes you will let him go to sea when he is old enough." Mr. Wallace smiled, and then sighed somewhat sadly. "Time enough to think of that, Jack. But I would rather he thought of something else. 'Tis a poor life and a hard one. But why do you not want to be a sailor?" Jack shook his head. "I should like to be an explorer, that is, I mean if you would let me. I should like to cross Australia, perhaps I might find Dr. Leichhardt," and his eyes glistened, "or else I should like to ride round it from Port Kooringa right up to Cape York, and along the Gulf of Carpentaria and the coast of Arnhem's Land and West Australia, and then along the Great Bight back to Kooringa. It would make me famous, father. Mother said it would be more than 10,000 miles. Mr. Wallace laughed. "More than that, Jack. But who knows what may happen. Perhaps I may buy some cattle country in Queensland someday, then you shall have a chance of doing some exploring. But not for some years yet, my boy," he added, placing his hand on his son's shoulder. "I do not want to go away from Kooringa yet, and I want to come back here, so that when my time comes I may be laid beside __her__. "Yes, Dad," said the lad simply, "I too want to be buried near poor mother when I die. Isn't it awful to think of dying at some place a long way from Kooringa, away from her? That's what I told Tom the other day. I said that if he goes to sea he might be drowned, or bitten in halves by a shark, like the two convicts who tried to cross the bar on a log when they ran away. Father, don't let Tom be a sailor. We might never see him again. Wouldn't it be awful if he never came back to us? And mother loved him so, didn't she? Don't you remember when she was dying how she made Tom lie down beside her on her bed, and cried, 'Oh, my Benjamin, my beloved?'" "Yes, my lad," answered the father, turning his face towards the sea, which shone and sparkled in the bright morning sunlight. Then the two rode on in silence, the man thinking of his dead wife, and the boy dreaming of that long, long ride of 10,000 miles, and of the strange sights he might yet see. From the broad front veranda of the quiet house, young Tom had watched his father and brother ride off towards the town, on their way to the river crossing which was some miles distant from the bar. Once over the river, they would have to return seaward along its northern bank, till they emerged upon the ocean beach. They would not return till nightfall, or perhaps till the following day, as Mr. Wallace wished to look for some missing cattle in the scrubs around the base of rugged Cape Gooringa, and Wellington, one of the Aboriginal stockmen, had already preceded them with a pack horse carrying their blankets and provisions, leaving Tom practically in charge, although old Foster, a somewhat rough and crusty ex-man of war's man, who had been Mrs. Wallace's attendant since her childhood, was nominally so. He with two or three women servants and the gardener were all that were employed in, and lived in the house itself, the rest of the hands having their quarters at the stockyards, which were nearly half a mile away. Tom watched his brother and father till they disappeared in the misty haze which at that early hour still hung about the beach and the low foreshore, although the sun had now, as Foster said, a good hoist, and the calm sea lay clear and blue beneath. Then something like a sigh escaped him, as his unwilling eye lighted upon his lesson books, which were lying upon the table of a little enclosure at one end of the veranda, which did duty as a schoolroom for his brother and himself. "Well, it can't be helped," he muttered. "I promised Dad to try and pull up a bit and there's the tide going out fast. How can a fellow dig into school books when he knows it's going to be a dead low tide, and the crayfish will be sticking their feelers up everywhere out of the kelp? Dad said 3 hours this morning. Now, what does it matter whether it is this morning, or this afternoon, or this evening? And of course underscore he underscore didn't think it would be such a lovely morning and he likes crayfish. I wonder if he will be angry when I tell him?" Then, stepping inside, he called out, "Foster, where are you?" There was a rattle of knives in the pantry, and then the old man shuffled along the passage, and came into the dining room. "What now, Master Tom?" he grumbled, "not at your lessons yet? 'Tis 9 o'clock. "Yes, I know, Foster. But, Foster, just look at the tip of flat rock showing up already. It's going to be a dead low tide, and—" "Don't you dare now. I know what you're going to say. No, I won't have it. Leastways I won't argue over it. And don't you disobey orders, not if all the crayfish in Australia was a running up out of the water, and climbing trees." Then, screwing his features up into an affectation of great wrath, he shuffled away again. Tom's face fell, and again a heavy sigh escaped him, as he looked at the shimmering sea, and saw that beyond the bar it was as smooth as a mountain lake. Then he quietly opened the Venetian shutters of the dining room, and let the bright sunlight stream in. "It's no use," he said to himself, "I can't work this morning. I'll try and think a bit whether I shall go or not." Over the mantel in the dining room was a marine picture. It was but rudely painted in watercolors, perhaps by some seaman's rough hand, and the lapse of 25 years had dimmed it sadly, but to Tom's mind it was the finest painting in the world, and redolent of wild adventure and romance. It showed as a background the shore of a tropical island, the hills clothed with jungle, and the yellow beach lined with palm trees, while in the foreground the blue rollers of the ocean churned into froth against a long curve of coral reef, on which lay a man of war, with the surf leaping high over her decks, and with main and mizzen masts gone. On the left of the picture was a beautiful white painted brig, with old-fashioned rolling topsails and with her main yard aback, and between her and the wreck were a number of boats crowded with men in uniform, escaping from the ship. Often when the house was silent had Tom, even when a boy of 10, stolen into the room, and, sitting cross-legged on the rug, gazed longingly at the painting which, to his boyish imagination, seemed to live, and speak to him in a wild symphony of crashing surf and swaying palm trees, mingling with the cries of the sailors and the shrill piping of the bosun's whistles. Then, too, his eyes would linger over the inscription that, in two lines, ran along the whole length of the foot of the picture, and he would read it over and over again to himself gloatingly, and let his mind revel in visions of what he would yet see when he grew old enough to sail on foreign seas, as his father and his uncle Fred Hemsley had done. This is what the inscription said, - "The wreck of the Dutch warship Samarang on the coast of Timor Laut, and the rescue of her crew by the English brig Huntress, of Sydney, commanded by Mr. William Fort, and owned by Frederick Hemsley, Esquire, of Amboina, on the morning of May 4, 1836. Half an hour later old Foster clattered suddenly along the veranda, peered into the schoolroom, and then into the dining room, where Tom sat in a chair still gazing at the picture. Rouse ye, Master Tom. Your eyes are better than mine. Here, look," and he placed Mr. Wallace's telescope in the boy's hand. "Look over there beyond Gooringa Rock. 'Tis a drifting boat, I believe. Kate tells me that it was in sight an hour ago, before your father and Master Jack went away, and yet the foolish creature never told me." Tom took the glass and old-fashioned telescope, half a fathom long, and steadied it against a veranda post. Have you got her? Asked old Foster.
Yes, yes, answered the boy, quickly, his hand shaking with excitement. I can see her, Foster. There are people in her,
yes, yes, and they are pulling. I can see the oars dipping quite plainly.
What boat can it be?
Shipwrecked people, of course. What would any other boat be doing out there, a-coming in from the eastward?
Can you see which way she is heading?
Straight in for the bar, Foster. And nothing but a steamer could stem the current now, with the tide running out at 6 knots, and more than that, they'll capsize as soon as they get abreast of flat rock, and be oughted up by the sharks.
Master Tom, we must man our boat somehow, and go out to them. Then we can pilot them into the bit of beach under Pilot's Hill, if the current is too strong for us to get back here.
But how we're going to launch the boat, let alone man her, is the trouble. There's not a man about the place but myself, and it will take the best part of an hour to send Kate or any other of the women to the town and back.
Never mind that, Foster, cried the boy. Look down there on the rocks. There are Combo, and Fly, and some other black fellows spearing fish. They will help us to launch the boat, and come with us too.
Then run, lad, run as hard as you can, and bring them up to the boat shed, and I'll follow as soon as I get what I want.
Seizing his cap, Tom darted away down the hill, across the beach, and then splashed through the shallow pools of water on the reef towards the party of Aboriginals, whilst old Foster, calling out to Kate and the other women to get food ready against his return, in case it might be wanted for starving people, hurriedly seized some empty bottles and filled them with water, then, thrusting them into Jack's fishing basket, which hung on the wall of the back veranda, he followed Tom down to the boatshed, where in a few minutes he was joined by the lad himself, and four stalwart, naked black fellows and their gins, all equally as excited as the old sailor. The boat was a long, heavy whaleboat, but she was soon run out of the dark shed under the hill, and then into the water.
Jump in, everybody, said old Foster, seizing the steer oar, and swinging the boat's head round to the open sea.
Chapter 2. Captain Ramon Castle and his men. Under the five oars, Tom tugging manfully at the bow, though still panting with his previous exertions, the boat soon cleared the entrance to the little rocky cove, which, during the old convict days, had been made into a fairly safe boat harbor, the only one, except an unfrequented beach under Pilot's Hill, for many miles along the coast. 5 minutes after the oars had touched the water, she was fairly racing seaward, for she was in the full run of the ebbing tide as it swept through the sandbanks and reefs which lined the narrow bar. Then, as the water deepened, and the current lost its strength, Foster shielded his eyes with his hands from the blazing sun, and looking ahead, tried to discern the approaching boat.
I can't see her anywhere, he exclaimed presently.
Easy there, pulling. Perhaps she's in a line with Kooringa Rock, and we won't see her for another half hour yet. Jump up, Combo, and take a look ahead.
Combo, a huge, black-bearded fellow, with a broad much-scarred chest, showed his white teeth, drew his oar across, and sprung upon the after thwart. For 2 or 3 seconds he scanned the sea ahead, then he pointed a little to the northward of Kooringa Rock.
I see him, he said with a laugh. He a long way yet other side Kooringa, 2 fell a mile yet, I think it. Then he added that the people in the boat had ceased pulling, and that she seemed to be drifting broadside to the southward with the current.
Old Foster nodded.
That'll do, Combo, my boy. You've eyes like a needle. I can't see for the sun blaze right ahead.
Give it to her, lads. Then he kept away a point or two to the southward, so as to pass close under Kooringa Rock, against the grim, weed-covered sides of which only the faintest swell rose and fell, to sway the hanging masses of green and yellow kelp to and fro. At any other time Tom's eyes would have reveled in the sight, and at the swarms of fish of all colors and shapes which swam to and fro in the clear water around the rock, or darted in and out amongst the moving kelp, but now his thoughts were centered solely on the boat's present mission. They were going to rescue what would most likely prove to be shipwrecked people, perhaps foreigners who could not speak English. Oh, how beautiful it was! And every nerve and fiber in his body thrilled with pleasure, as, with the perspiration streaming down his face, he watched his oar, and listened for the next word of command from the old sailor. For a brief minute or two, as the boat passed along the base of the towering dome above, the fierce sun was lost, and Tom gave a sigh of relief, for although he had thrown off all but his shirt and trousers, his exertions were beginning to tell upon him, and he looked with something like envy at the smooth, naked backs of Combo and his sooty companions, who took no heed of the sun, but whose dark eyes gazed longingly at the white masses of breeding gulls and boobies which covered the grassy ledges near the summit of the rock. Then out again into the dazzling glare once more,
And Foster gave a cry of vast pulling. There she is, close to, but pulling away from us. Tom jumped up and looked, and saw the strange boat. She was not more than half a mile away, and he could see the people in her quite plainly. She was again heading towards the entrance to the bar.
"Give way, lads," said Foster. "They are only pulling 3 oars to our 5, and we'll soon be within hailing of them. They can't make any headway against the ebb when they get in a bit further, and are bound to see us afore many minutes." The crew, black and white, needed no encouragement, and without a word bent to their oars again, and pulled steadily on for less than a quarter of an hour. Then Foster stood up and hailed with all the strength of his lungs, but still the 3 oars of the strange boat were dipped steadily though slowly, and she still went on. "They're not looking this way," muttered the old man to Combo and his listening companions. Then Combo himself, drawing in a deep breath, stood up and sent out a long, loud ! As the strange weird cry traveled over the waters, Foster and his companions watched intently, and then gave a loud hurrah. As they saw the rowers cease, and figures stand up in the other boat, then presently there came back a faint answering cry, and they saw an oar was appended, as a sign that they were seen. It stood thus for a few seconds, then was lowered, and the strange boat slewed round, and began pulling towards them. "Steady, now steady," said Foster, warningly, to his crew, who began pulling with redoubled energy. "Go easy, we'll be alongside in no time now. Master Tom, in with your oar, and come aft here. Take out a couple of those bottles of water, and keep them handy, but put the others out of sight until I tell you. There's a power of men in that boat, I can see, and I know what happens to a man perish in a thirst, when he gets his lips to water, and has no one to stand by him and take a turn in his swallow." Tom stumbled aft pantingly, and did as he was bid, and then, looking up, he saw the other boat was not 100 yards away, and appeared crowded with men. Then followed a wild clamor of voices and cries, as the two boats touched gunwales, and a strange, rugged figure, who stood in the stern, cried out to Foster. "Thank God, you are a white man. Have you any water? Ours was finished last night."
"Enough to give you all a small drink," replied Foster, quickly, as he handed the bottles over to him one by one, "but we shall be ashore in another hour. Now, sir, tell some of your men to get into my boat as soon as they've had a drink." Although the castaways were the wildest-looking beings ever seen out of a picture book, they still preserved discipline, and one of them at once began sharing out the water to the others, whilst the man who was steering, with his hand shaking with excitement, poured out a little into a tin mug, handed the rest back to Foster with an imploring look, and then sank on his knees in the bottom of the boat beside a small, crouched-up figure clothed in a dirty calico shirt. As Tom bent over to look, he saw that it was a child, a little girl about 5 or 6 years of age. She put her hand out to the mug, and with her eyes still closed drank it eagerly.
"No more, sir, just now," cried Foster warningly to the man, who, with a great sob of joy, and the tears streaming from his haggard and sun-blackened face, had extended his hand for the bottle. "No more just now for the little one. Pass her into my boat, and get in yourself, but first take some of this," and he poured out a full drink. The officer took it, drank half, and then returned it. "Is that all that is left? Are you sure that we are safe? For God's sake, keep what is left for my child."
Ay, sir. Have no fear. In another hour we shall be ashore. But hand me the little one, sir. Pass me a tow line here, some of you chaps, and you, Combo, and Fly, and the other chap, put on all your beef, and pull with all your might. Tom, you sit down there with the captain, and hold the babby.
Never fear, sir, he'll hold her safe. God bless her, dear little mite. Cheer up, sir, food and rest is all she wants, and all you and these other poor chaps want. Pull, Combo, my hearty, pull, Fly, send her along as she never went before.
Tom, unheeding the excitement of those around him, as a towline was passed from the other boat and made fast, and Combo and his two black companions, aided by one of the castaway sailors, bent to their oars and tautened it out, was gazing into the face of his charge, who lay quietly breathing in his arms, whilst her father, weak and exhausted as he was telling old Foster his story of disaster and death. It was the first time in Tom's life that he had ever held a baby, as he mentally termed a little girl, in his arms, and under any other circumstances his youthful soul would have recoiled from such a position with horror. But presently, as she turned her face to his, and said in a thin, weak voice, "Give me some water, please," he began to shake at the knees, and feel frightened and intensely sympathetic at the same time.
"Only a little, Master Tom,
only a mouthful at a time, and old Foster, his face aglow with excitement, handed him the bottle of water and mug, and Tom carefully poured out about a wine glassful, and put it to the lips of what, to his mind, seemed more like a dying monkey, with a wig of long black hair, than a real human child. As the boats drew near the little boat harbor under Pilot's Hill, even the exhausted seaman in the one which was being towed gave a faint cheer, shipped their oars, and began to pull. The sea was still glassy smooth, for it was in November, when a calm would sometimes last for 3 days and more, only to be succeeded by a black northeasterly gale. Standing on the shore awaiting the boats were nearly every one of Mr. Wallace's people, who were presently joined by some few of the townspeople, who had heard of something being afoot at the beach house, as the Wallace's place was called. "Jump out, Master Tom," cried Foster, as the leading boat touched the soft, yielding sand, "and give the baby to Kate. She'll know what to do." Tom, his chest swelling with a mighty dignity, surrendered his charge to its father for the moment, leapt out of the boat, and then held out his arms again for it, as if he had been used to carrying babies all his life, and Kate Gorman, a big-boned red-headed Irish woman, splashed into the water with eyes aflame, and whipped the child away from him, and then, followed by the other women, and cuddling the now wondering child to her ample bosom, she pushed through the rest of the people, and strode up the grassy hill, leaving Tom bereft of his dignity and importance together. Food and drink in plenty had been brought by the women, as Foster had ordered, and the famished seamen, after satisfying themselves, lay down upon the sweet-smelling grass above high water, to stretch and rest their cramped and aching limbs, before setting out to walk to Beach House along the edge of the cliffs, for there was no other way. And then there came to Tom the proudest moment of his life, when old Foster, who was sitting on the grass with the dark-faced, haggard man whom he had addressed as Sir, beckoned him to come near, and, rising to his feet, said, "And this, Captain, is Master Tom Wallace, Sir, the Master's son. I sarved with his mother's father, and—" The Captain stretched out his hand to the boy, and grasped it warmly, as Tom hung his head and shuffled his feet, his face a deep red the while with delight. "And now, Master Tom," resumed old Foster, throwing back his chest and trying to speak with great dignity, "there's a great responsibility on us until your father comes home. Do you think you can find him at Cape Gouringa, and tell him to come back as quick as possible, inasmuch as there is a party of suffering and distressed seamen landed at his door, one of which is an infant, and needs medical aid at once?" Tom's face beamed. "I can saddle a horse and be at the cattle camp at Cape Gouringa long before sunrise. Is there any other message, Mr. Foster?" "Yes, tell your father that there are 13 men, including the captain, and one infant child. Name of Captain Raymond Cashall, name of ship Bandelier. Ran ashore on the south end of Middleton Reef, on a certain date, slipped off again and foundered in deep water. One boat, with chief mate and 7 men, still a missing. Can you remember all them official details, Tom?" "Yes, Mr. Foster," said Tom, who had before this heard the old sailor use similarly impressive language when occasion demanded it. "Then, as soon as you gets to the house, and before you saddles your horse and goes off in persons of your duty, I request that you will request Kate Gorman to send some person, Mrs. Potter's boy will do, to meet me and the captain and his distressed and suffering seamen, with 2 or more bottles of brandy, and some water, the key of the lazarette being in my room. Please tell your father that these are suffering and distressed seamen, with an infant as mentioned, with no clothes, the ship having gone down sudden soon after striking, the second mate and the captain's wife having died through being drowned when the ship struck and washed overboard by a heavy sea, with 2 men, a Bengali steward, another man name unknown, and a native nurse girl." With this rapidly delivered and puzzling message beating King Bob's in his already excited brain, Tom started off, hotfoot. The lazarette he knew to mean the sailor Foster was fond of using the term. Kate Gorman had lived with them ever since Jack's birth. Kate, red-fisted, red-haired, and honest-hearted, met the boy at the door, her rough freckled face beaming with smiles, though her red-hot tongue had a minute before been going unusually fast, as she rated and bullied the under-servants for being slow in bringing hot weather and flannels for the blessed child. "The brandy shall Mr. Foster have within 20 minutes by the grace of God, for I'll bust open the door of his lazarette without your passing about for his old keys. But not a step shall ye move yourself till ye've oughten and drunk something afore ye go riding along to Gouringa, and the black of the night a-coming on fast." And then the big Irish woman, bustling and bristling with importance, yet speaking in a low voice on account of the swathe-blessed child who lay slumbering on a bed that in Kate's eyes was forever sacred, hurried first to the kitchen, and then to the stables, and, before he knew it, Tom's horse was ready saddled, and a huge dinner steaming and smoking placed before him.
"I can't eat, Kate," he said, "it is no use my trying. I want to get to Coringa Cape tonight. I promised Foster."
Kate bent down and clasped him in her arms.
"And God go wid ye, Tom, me darlin'. Sure there's no danger, though 'tis a lonely ride along the beach. And, Tom, darlin', me swate, ask your father to hurry, hurry, hurry. For though I've niver born a child myself, 'tis plain to me it is that the little one that lies a-slappin' in your own mother's bed, will niver, niver wake in this world, unless some strategy is done. And there's no doctor widin 50 mile off Port Coringa, but the master is full of doctor and strategy. So away ye go, Tom, and all the blessings of God go wid ye." So Tom, with a thrill of exultation and pride, led his horse down the hill to the shore, and springing into the saddle, set off at a steady trot along the long curving beach, towards the grey loom of Coringa Cape, 50 miles away.
Chapter 3. How Tom lit a fire on Misty Head, and what came of it. Restraining his desire to put his horse into a gallop, Tom went steadily along for the first 8 or 10 miles, riding as near as possible to the water's edge, where the sand was hard, though by this time the tide was rising, and he knew that in another hour he would have to leave the beach entirely and pick up a cattle track, which ran through the thick scrub, a few hundred yards back from high water mark. Although the sun was still very hot, a southeasterly breeze had sprung up, and its cooling breath fanned the boy's heated face, and gave an added zest to the happiness of his spirits, for he was happy enough in all conscience. Here was he thought, only 13 years of age, and the participator in the rescue of a shipwrecked crew, the full tale of whose disaster had yet to be told. Where, he wondered, did the Bandolier sail from, and whither was she bound, when she ran ashore at Middleton Reef? Oh, how heavenly it would be tomorrow, when he, and his father, and Jack were back at home, listening to the story of the wreck. And what strange-looking, tattooed sailors were those with the reddish-brown skins, and the straight jet-black hair like Red Indians? South Sea Islanders, of course. But of what islands? And how long would they stay at Port Coringa? Oh, how beautiful it would be if they could not get away for a long time, so that he might make friends with them all. Perhaps some of the brown men with the tattooed arms and legs would teach him to talk their language, and tell him about their island homes, where the palm trees grew thickly on the beaches, and the canoes floated upon the deep blue waters of the reef-encircled lagoons. Perhaps Captain Castle might take a liking to him, and he bent over his saddle and flushed with pleasure at the mere thought and take him away when he got another ship. Oh, he did so hope that his father and the captain would become friends, then it would be so much easier, the it being his father's consent to his becoming a sailor. And so with such thoughts as these chasing quickly through his imagination, he was at last recalled to the present by the sound of splashing about his horse's feet, as the spent rollers sent every now and then thin, clear sheets of water swashing gently up the sand. "Come, Peter, old chap," he said, patting his willing horse on the neck, "we must get up out of this onto the track, it's getting too soft," and jumping off, he led the animal straight up over the loose, yielding sand which lay between the water's edge and the fringe of the scrub. Taking a drink from his canvas water bag as he reached the end of the sand, he mounted again, and was soon riding along the track, which ran through a forest of native apple, whose thick umbrageous canopies of dark green shut out the sunlight so effectually, that the sudden transition made it appear as if he had moved from light to semi-darkness. From the leafy crowns of the trees, and stretching across or hanging in giant loops upon the ground, or swinging high above, was a network of great snaky vines, black, brown, and mottled, and so full of water that, as Tom well knew, he had but to cut off a 4-foot length to obtain a full quart of the clear though astringent liquid. Now and then, as his horse's shoeless feet disturbed the loose carpet of fallen leaves, a frightened wallaby would bound away with heavy thumping leaps into the still gloomier shadows on the left, or down towards the ocean, whose softened and lulling murmur sounded as if the shore on which its waves curled and broke were miles and miles away, instead of scarce more than a stone's throw, though now and then, when the sea breeze rustled the dome of green above, it sang its never-ending song in louder tone. Sometimes there came a whir of wings, as with harsh screaming notes a flock of green and golden parakeets, intent upon feeding on the ripe wild apples, would flash by, and their cries perhaps be answered by the long-drawn-out note of a stock-whip bird. The end of the first belt of scrub at last, and Tom emerged out into the open again, a wide stretch of dried-up swamp, along the seaward margin of which the track led in a waving line of white, hardened clay. Far back on the other side were clumps of tall, melancholy swamp gums, and beyond these the thickly timbered spurs of the Coast Range, standing out clearly and sharply in the blaze of the sinking sun.
"Come, Peter, my boy, it's getting cooler now, and you shall have a drink when we get to the rocky waterholes, behind Misty Head," and Peter, tough old stock horse, to whom 50 miles, with such a lightweight and easy-handed rider as was Tom, was a matter of no hardship, shook his clean-cut head, and giving an answering snort, set off at a steady swift canter, glad to be free of the curse of pestering flies, which in the sunlight hung about his nostrils, and crept into the corners of his big black eyes. An hour later, and just as the sun had sunk, a blazing ball of yellow, behind the purpling range, Tom drew rein at a spot known as the Rocky Waterholes, a series of small deep pools of limpid water at the back of a headland, whose high bold front rose stark from the sea. He had still 25 miles to ride before reaching the cattle camp at Curring a Cape, where he expected to find his father and Jack, unless, indeed, he met them returning driving the missing cattle, which was hardly likely, without they had met with them near a great freshwater swamp at the back of Misty Head. Anyway, he thought, he would give Peter a bit of a spell for half an hour. If his father and Jack were already returning, they would be almost sure to stop at the rocky waterholes, and wait till the tide fell again, which would be towards dawn, instead of trying to drive the cattle along the track through the scrub in the darkness, and run the risk of some of them breaking away, and being lost. Leading Peter up to one of the waterholes, he let him drink his fill, and unbuckling the ends of the bridle, turned the animal adrift to feed upon the sweet grass and juicy pig face growing lower down. Then a sudden inspiration came to Tom. He would light a fire on the top of Misty Head, it would only take a few minutes, and if his father and Jack happened to be near, they would be sure to come and see who had lit it, and thus he could not possibly miss them. The landward side of the head was mostly covered with a dense thicket, resembling the English privet, but as it did not reach higher than his waist, Tom forced his way through, and with some difficulty reached the summit, a little cleared space less than half an acre in extent, and free of scrub, but covered with coarse, dry grass about a foot high, swaying and rustling to the wind, which as the sunset had freshened. Lower down, on both sides, were a number of thick, stunted honeysuckles, and feeling his way very cautiously for a slip meant a fall of 200 feet or more into the sea below, Tom began to collect some of the dead branches, and then returned with them to the top. Once he had lit a fire, he would have light enough to show him where to find a thicker log or two, for there were many dead honeysuckles about, he knew, as the place was familiar to him. Pulling up some of the dried grass, and placing some twigs on the top, he struck a match and lit the heap. It blazed up crisply, and in a few minutes he could see his surroundings clearly. "That's all right," said Tom to himself, "now for some big logs, and then I'll be off." 50 feet away, the gnarled and rugged branches of a dead and fallen honeysuckle stood revealed in the firelight, and he walked toward it. Taking hold of one of the largest branches, he began to drag it towards the fire, when he felt the smart puff of wind, and then heard an ominous crackle behind him, and then followed a sudden blaze of light the long grass around the fire had caught, and a puff of wind had carried the flames to the scrub. Too late to avert the disaster, Tom dropped the log with a cry of terror, for he knew what a bushfire that dry time of the year meant, and, most of all, he dreaded the anger of his father for his carelessness. For a moment or two he stood gazing at the result of his folly, and then a cry of alarm broke from his lips as another eddying gust of wind came, and the flames answered with a roar as they swept through the scrub with a speed and fury that told Tom that in a few minutes they would be leaping and crashing into the timber on the other side of the rocky waterholes, and thence into the ranges beyond. And then, too, not only was his own retreat cut off, but the fire on the summit was eating its way to windward, and unless he could find some place of retreat on the sea face or sides of the head, he stood a very good chance of becoming a victim to his own stupidity. As he looked about, undecided whether to try to get in advance of the flames by forcing his way through the dense jungle of the north side, down to the water, and then clambering along the rocks to where he had left his horse, or get over the edge of the cliff to a place of safety, there came another bursting roar, and a huge wall of flame sprang up and leapt and crashed through the gums and other lofty trees which grew close to the landward side of the waterholes the bush itself had caught. And as Tom gazed in guilty fear at the scene of devastation, he saw his horse break through the stunted herbage above the beach on the north side and gallop down to the water, where he stopped, terrified at the sudden rush of fire, and, no doubt, wondering what had become of his master.
The sight of the horse standing there on the beach in full glare of the flames, which now were lighting up the sea and hiding the land beyond in dense volumes of blood-red smoke, as the wind carried them inland, filled the boy's heart with a new fear for his father and Jack. Perhaps at that moment they were between Misty Head and the range. If so, then they were in imminent danger, for he knew that, unless they were near the beach, they would be cut off and perish, for now the wind, as if to aid in the work of destruction, was blowing strongly. A prayer that they might be far away at Kuringake rose to his lips, and then, as he saw Peter still standing and looking about in expectancy, he, like a brave lad, pulled himself together. He would climb down the north side of the head, before the fire, which was steadily working downward to the water, cut him off from the mainland altogether, and kept him there until morning. Force his way down through the close scrub he could not, for the rapidly creeping flames, feeding upon the dried leaves and undergrowth, would overtake him before he was halfway down, but there was, he knew, a break in the density of the scrub, caused by a zigzag and narrow cleft in the side of the head, reaching from near the summit to the boulders of black trap rock at the foot. A few minutes' search showed him the most suitable spot from where to begin the descent, and guided by the light of the fire which revealed every leaf and stone as clearly as if it were broad daylight, he soon reached the top of the cleft, which for the first 50 or 60 feet ran eastwards towards the beach, and then made a sudden and downward turn to the sea. The sides, though terribly rugged, afforded him excellent facilities for descent, as, besides the jutting stones which protruded out of the soil, tough vines and short strong shrubs gave him good support. "Easier than I imagined," said Tom to himself, thinking of the pride he would have in relating his feat to Jack in the morning. "Now here's the beginning of the straight up and down part." Grasping the thin stem of a small stumpy tree, with prickly leaves, known to the boys as Bandy Leg, he peered over. Suddenly he felt that the tree was yielding at the roots. He flung out his left hand for further support, and clutched a vine about as thick as a lead pencil. It broke, and, with a gasp of terror, poor Tom pitched headlong down, bounding from side to side, and crashing through the stunted herbage, till he struck the bottom, where he lay stunned and helpless, and bleeding from a jagged cut on the back of his head. For some time he lay thus, and then, as returning consciousness came, he groaned in agony, for, besides the wound on his head, the fingers of his left hand were crushed, and he felt as if the arm were half torn from the socket. Wiping the dust and rubble, with which he was nearly blinded, from his face, he drew himself up into a sitting position, and began to feel his left arm from the shoulder down, fearing from the intense pain that one or more bones were broken, but in a few moments he found he could bend it. Groping about carefully for the spot where he had fallen was in darkness, though he could discern the sea, not far below, still gleaming dully from the light of the fire. He found that the soil and rocks about him were quite dry and warm to the touch, evidently, therefore, he was some distance from the base of the head and above high water mark. Slowly and painfully he crawled towards the opening, and discovered that he was about 20 feet over the water, just at the point where all vegetation ceased and bare rock began. Already he was feeling thirst, and had he been able to use his left arm, he would have climbed down to the sea and swum round to the beach, where he felt sure that Peter was still awaiting him, with the water bag hanging to the saddle-dees. He leant his back against a rock, for now a deadly sickness came over him, and he went off into a long faint. 10 miles away, and camped near a grassy headland known as the Green Bluff, was a party of 11 men, 3 of whom were watching the red glow of Misty Head, the rest were lying upon the grass, sleeping the sleep of exhausted nature. The 3 who watched were Mr. Wallace, Jack, and the black stockman, Wellington. Those who slept were the first mate and 7 of a boat's crew of the Bandolier. Only a few hours previously the latter had made the coast at the mouth of a small freshwater creek, running into the sea at the Green Bluff, and were discovered there by Jack, who was tailing some cows and calves on the bank, whilst his father and Wellington were looking for the rest of the missing cattle further up the creek. The moment Jack heard the officer's story, he ran to the pack horse, which was quietly standing under the shade of a mimosa, unshipped the packs, containing cooked beef, damper, and tea and sugar, and lit a fire, whilst one of the sailors filled the big 6-quart billy with water from the creek. Then, picking up his father's shotgun which was carried on the pack horse, he loaded it with ball, jumped on his horse again, cut off a cow with a year-old calf from the rest of the mob, drove them a little apart from the others, and sent a bullet into the calf's head. Without wasting time to skin the animal, the half-famished seaman set about cutting up and cooking it, having first devoured the piece of cooked beef and damper. Then waving his hand to the officer, and telling him that he would be back with his father in an hour or less, Jack set off at a gallop in search of him. The officer, a tall, hatchet-faced New Englander, nodded his head, his mouth being too full to speak, and then turned his hollow eyes with a look of intense satisfaction and solicitude upon the frizzling and blood-stained masses of veal. Towards sunset, Mr. Wallace, Jack, and Wellington came cantering down along the bank of the creek, and the genial, kind-hearted squatter, though the advent of the shipwrecked men meant the abandonment of his search for the rest of the cattle, and the loss of much valuable time, sprang from his horse, and shook hands warmly with the officer, as he congratulated him upon his safe arrival. "You must camp here with us tonight," he said, "and perhaps tomorrow as well, or at least until such time as you and your men are sufficiently recovered to walk to Port Kooringa. In the morning, however, I shall send my black boy on in advance, and he will meet us with some more provisions. For the present we can manage. The creek is alive with fish, fresh beef is in plenty," pointing to the grazing mob of cows and calves, "and you and your men, above all things, need rest. Now, tell me, do you smoke?"
"Smoke, mister?"
And the man's voice shook. "If I get a smoke I'll just be in heaven. But I can't do it here, with those poor men looking at me. Every one of them is as good a man as me, although I did have tear belt the life out of them sometimes." Mr. Wallace slipped his pipe, tobacco pouch, and a box of matches into the officer's hand. "Go down to the creek and lie down there and smoke," he said with a smile. "I wish I had more tobacco for your men." As the mate crept away like a criminal, clutching the precious pipe and tobacco in his gaunt, sun-baked hand, Wellington cried out, and pointed towards Misty Head.
"Hello?
Look over there. Big feller fire along a Misty Head." Mr. Wallace turned and watched, and as he saw the lurid flames and huge volumes of smoke rise, and then sweep quickly down the incline of the head, toward the dark line of bush beyond, he could not repress a groan of vexation and anger, for he knew that, with such a strong breeze, the whole coast would be aflame in a few hours, and hundreds of miles of country on Kooringa Run be swept in its devastating course, and cause him to lose some thousands of pounds. Then in addition to this, and of more importance to his generous mind, for money itself held no sway on a nature such as his, was the fact that he and the shipwrecked seamen would have to make their way to Port Kooringa along the beach as the tide served, for they could not for some days traverse the burnt-out country at the back of the many headlands and capes, as the ground would be a furnace covered with ashes. Towards midnight, Wellington, who was on watch, roused his master, and reported that the fire was rapidly traveling towards the green bluff, and would be upon them in an hour. This was serious, for there was no beach to which they could retreat on either side of the bluff for many miles, and the country on the opposite side of the little creek was, though free from scrub, clothed in long grass, which a single flying spark would set ablaze. Awakening the officer, he explained the situation to him, and suggested a way of escaping from the danger which menaced them by taking to the boat, putting to sea, and making direct for Port Kooringa at once. Tired as were the mate and his men, they at once acquiesced. The cattle and horses were driven across the creek, and left to take care of themselves, the boat's water breaker filled, and the saddles and other gear were placed in the boat, only just in time, for already the heat of the flames was getting oppressive. There was but little surf at the mouth of the creek, and the instant the boat had passed through it, the ragged sail was set, and she slipped through the water. "Don't go too close to Misty Head," said Mr. Wallace to the officer. "There is always a strong tide rip there." The officer altered the boat's course. Poor Tom, just as the daylight broke, saw her sail pass about a mile off. He stood up and shouted till he was hoarse, and then, when he realized that she was too far off for him to be heard, or even seen in such a position, sat down and wept, forgetting his bodily pain in his anguish of spirit. But, as the sun rose, his thirst became overpowering, and rising to his feet with a prayer for strength upon his lips, he began to make his way along the foot of the rocks. His arm was less painful now, but three of his fingers were black, swollen, and useless, and the wound in his head every now and then made him faint. When halfway to the beach, he saw that the water was sufficiently shallow for him to wade ashore on the clear, sandy bottom, instead of toiling over the rocks. So getting down at a spot where it was not over his knees, he first immersed his whole body and then bathed his head and face. The stinging, smarting sensation caused him fresh pain, but he set his teeth and bore it manfully, knowing that the salt water would do the cut on his head more good than harm, even though it made it bleed afresh. With renewed courage, for the cool water had revived him wonderfully, he waded along cheerfully, his thoughts now turning to his father and Jack, for whom he was not at all alarmed, knowing that both of them were too good bushmen to be caught by a bushfire, no matter how suddenly it had come upon them. If they were camped at Kooringa Cape, there was no danger for them at all, as a few miles this side of it there was a wide tidal river, and if they had been anywhere near the rocky waterholes when the fire started, they would have sought safety on one of the small islands in the big swamp. Anyway, he would be home tomorrow, or the next day, if he had to keep to the beach, and no doubt would meet someone coming to look for him, for unless Peter had met his father's party, the animal was bound to make for home, and be seen by some person. Then that boat. Of course it must have been the missing boat from the Bandolier. No other boat would be coming down the coast, surely. Oh, if he were only home to know. But a drink first before he decided what to do. Stepping out of the water onto the hard dry sand, Tom ascended the bank, and then a cry of dismay escaped from him. The rocky waterholes were surrounded by a belt of blazing logs, and it was impossible for him to approach within 100 yards, and the holes themselves were not to be seen. Tom returned to the beach to consider. He must get a drink, and there was none to be had on the way back home, except from the thick vines in the scrub through which he had ridden the previous morning. But was there any scrub left? As far as he could see to the southward, the coast was still